All right, hey, welcome back to JK Moto Podcast, motorcycle podcast for the everyday rider, covering current bike and racing news and specializing in track days, club racing, and great entertainment. We truly do it all. This week, we are brought to you, once again, by JK Moto Entertainment, as seen. Your one-stop shop for all of your track day, club racing, motorcycle information, content, reviews, track reviews. We kind of just do a grand mix of everything, try and put out a video every week. So go ahead and check out the YouTube channel. Find us there on YouTube. Subscribe to the channel when you head over there. You can find this podcast just about everywhere. Apple Podcast, Google, YouTube, Amazon, Preacher.
Spotify,
iHeartRadio. We're everywhere. We're all over. So go check us out. Give us a follow on there and then leave us a review. We appreciate it. Tonight, I am joined once again by one of my favorite guests, Kelly.
I'm Kelly. Hello.
And we are, if you see us drinking, we are not sponsored, but tonight's episode is brought to you by an energy drink that will not be named. So. Because it is late, but anyway, that's the pitch, that's the start. What do you want to talk about?
Crashing, possibly, MotoGP liveries.
Okay.
Where do you want to start?
Well, we should probably roll an intro.
Okay.
And then we can get into some MotoGP, little preseason coverage, some thoughts and opinions. Right before we roll the intro, we'll let you know we are kind of pre-filming this, so it is not the date that this is actually airing on. We're doing a little bit of pre-filming, which is kind of different for this podcast, so be ready for more of that as the future rolls out. But let's go ahead and roll an intro, and we'll get into a little bit of MotoGP, and then we'll get back on my favorite recent topic, which is crashing motorcycles compared to riding them.
My first track day, I got the pictures back, and I was like, I'm never doing that again. On the ground at 100 miles an hour.
Oh yeah, like I said, favorite riders would be Fabio Quartararo and Jorge Martin. It's just unfortunate that Yamaha isn't that really competitive, but they're bringing a new V4 package soon, so I'd be very curious to see what that looks like.
Yeah, so I want to be honest. One, I haven't been keeping up very well with MotoGP news. I've been kind of down and out. So if I'm missing something for the audience, sorry. But, yeah, I mean, Yamaha's still got Rins Quartararo, which Rins, what are your thoughts on Rins?
Don't really have a whole bunch of thoughts on Rins as is. I know he's Alloy's performing right now. I'm there for, like, Yamaha in general, and then Fabio Quartararo, and then, like, anybody else other than that is, like, secondary.
Okay. Yamaha fanboy kind of deal? Okay.
In much the same way that I was a big fan of Primack, because they had Jorge Martin, and now Jorge's leaving, so now my allegiance to Primack is non-existent.
Just shove that over.
And now, now I'm going to buy all my Aprilia merch, become an Aprilia fanboy.
Well, hey, we gotta talk about that. Aprilia. So Aprilia snatched up, right, they lost both their guys, which the Maverick one confused me, but we talked about that last year. That threw me for a huge loop. But they lost Maverick, they lost Aleix. Aleix retired, right? Maverick went over to KTM, non-factory. And then they snatched up Jorge Martin and then Bezzecchi, which Bezzecchi's not bad.
He's not bad. I don't want to say he's doing bad. He wasn't doing that great compared to everybody else on a Ducati, I believe. Mm-hmm. He's doing all right. I'd be interested to see how he performs on an Aprilia, though, this year.
It'll be interesting.
That bike last year had its highs and its lows. When it was doing good, it was doing really good.
Yeah.
When it was not, it was
well, that's the,
not.
I mean, that's the hard part, is that Aprilia always feels like it's either, like, I mean, just like, yeah, like you just said, it's either up or down, right? Like, they show up 1 week and they're going to do great, and they do amazing, and then they show up the next week and their consistency is just blown. Like, they don't have any consistency. But the colors, the livery, since we got to talk about livery.
So, for the liveries that have been released so far, a lot of them do look the same. Like, in terms of Aprilia specifically, still mostly the black with a few accent colors.
Yeah.
Wasn't bad by any means. Mm-hmm. It was classic. I liked it a lot, but for the Aprilia bikes on the grid. Trackhouse, though.
Trackhouse, big change.
Trackhouse, big change, and those are some of my favorite colors. That is my favorite livery of the liveries that have been revealed so far.
Really? So it's the blue with the yellow?
Yeah, I love the blue.
Mostly blue? Interesting. See, I was a little thrown off because Trackhouse came out their first year. They're American-owned, American-made, whatever, and they came out with this like super American livery, which I liked a lot. And then this year is just like blue.
I do agree. That last livery was really good, but that blue and that green, kind of neon green, but not quite neon green, I'm really big fan of it.
Okay. All right.
Definitely different.
Yeah. I mean, it was different. There's a lot of, like, solid. There weren't that many sponsors on there. Not that many, like, stripes or anything. It was kind of almost feels like it, and that's, from what I've seen so far across the table, feels like we're almost going, like, a couple steps back.
In terms of, like, the sponsorship branding on the side of the bike or just?
Just, like, styling of the livery.
Stylistically?
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm not sure if all the sponsors are on all the bikes right now, at least from what I saw with the Aprilia picture for Trackhouse. I do think when the bikes hit the grid, there'd probably be like some more sponsorship logos.
Yeah, they
on
could
it
be still kind of nailing that down. That's fair. Usually,
like the big stuff like Ducati, Lenovo, you can still see some of that, but like all the other side ones, I haven't seen really that yet.
But big news, like huge news, which once again, we're filming this way ahead of time, so everyone knows this, but we're going to talk about it. Jorge Martin. One, we got to talk about him. And we've had this conversation multiple times, so we're going to have it again. But just starting off with, he's running the number one plate officially.
I do think that if he's going to run the number one plate, he might as well run it. Like, he won the championship. Yep. He earned the right to wear it. I love Jorge Martin to death. He's a really good rider. But for first year, brand new team, brand new like group of people, brand new motorcycle to him, I'm sure he'll adapt quickly. But will he be in running for the championship? I'm not so sure. So if he's going to run the number one, he might as well run it now. He's really good, but the fact that Ducati maintains being dominant and Ducati is going to have a powerhouse of the Marc Marquez and Pecco Bagnaia, I do think that's the 1-2. That's the favored 1-2 going into the 2025 season. As much as I like, would love to hate on Ducati just to be, you know.
Yeah, the anti-Ducati group.
Anti-Ducati group for no particular reason other than they're winning. I love Ducati, by the way, but still, like, they're definitely going to get the 1-2 this year, most likely.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm excited because Jorge Martin is good, yeah. I think, right? He's a great rider. And but the hard part was that I would argue that Maverick, like, had talent. The issue was that Aprilia is not consistent and Maverick wasn't consistent. And so those two combined, you get, like, one weekend a year or
what was
a season.
That? What was that, Coda?
Yeah,
when he
right.
Went Coda.
Like one
the
week
Batman,
in a season,
not the top
yeah,
gun.
Where they actually come out and they do it right. And so I'm hoping that even if Aprilia stays non-consistent, Jorge Martin comes out and can be consistent and produce at least a couple more of those good weekends.
I too am hoping for that because like what I don't want is the same 1-2 in the grid every weekend. I would still like to see battling. I'd still like to see you know some actual racing, some good racing. I would like to see some close calls just to keep it more exciting for the fans. Such as myself. Moving forward, like I watch F1. I know we don't really talk about F1 on this channel, but I watch F1, and I'm a big Red Bull fan. But a lot of people who are not Red Bull fans were complaining for a couple years that like this team kept winning, and I get it, right?
Yeah.
I want my team to win, but for the health of the sport, more people want to see racing.
Yeah, to a degree, but I mean, like, I don't know. I guess I didn't watch much. That just makes me think of like Marc Marquez was winning for like. Seven or six, you know, six consecutive years pretty much took the top every time.
So I knew that, but I didn't. Obviously, last year was my first year watching MotoGP start to finish. Mm-hmm. I knew Marc Marquez was a multi-year championship prior to the injury.
Yeah.
I didn't know if those were like consecutive. I didn't know if those were like he's getting first place every single race and it's not even close, like a 20-second gap. I don't know if that was like, no, there was some good racing, and he won statistically, point-wise, the most, so he maintained his championship.
Let me say that they threw up, I don't remember where I saw it, I think it was just on Facebook, but they threw up a post of, like, the Ducati garage. It had Mark, and it had Pecco, and it had, like, their stats. And the only thing that Mark didn't have anywhere near Pecco was sprint wins, because Mark's only won one sprint. At least per that chart.
Also, sprint isn't the sprint like format in general relatively new to MotoGP?
Yeah.
Within the last few years?
Yeah, last 2 years ago was the first year.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of it. But there was one compared to 11. The rest of it was like blows him out of the water, which is mostly because he has more time. But also, in that time that he had, he was, I mean, he was the greatest. His 2019 season was nuts, and everyone that watches this podcast is very over me talking about it all the time. But but it'll be... People are predicting like a slaughterhouse from Mark this year. I'm not predicting that.
I personally do think it's going to be Marquez, Pecco, 1-2.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that.
I did think Marquez was all hype because when I got into MotoGP, I started watching, like, what is it? There Can Only Be One, which is like a recap of the season.
Yeah.
So I watched that for like the two seasons or the season prior to 2025. So I kind of got a background for who some of the riders were. And Marquez obviously wasn't like that competitive or even racing in some of those seasons.
Yeah.
But I knew he was good. People kept talking about him. And then I saw him once he got the hang of the Gresini Ducati this last season. And I was like, oh no, he still got it.
Yeah. I mean, he's Mark Marquez. But we don't need to dwell on that. I'm hoping my prediction, much like you, I think, Mark Marquez 1, Pecco 2. I'm hoping that every race it is, like every weekend, let's say, it's a shot in the dark as to is it Mark, Pecco, or Jorge. I hope Jorge stays up there. It's going to be weird because he's not on that factory Ducati. And, yeah. But maybe Aprilia can kind of pull something out. I know they've been working really hard over the offseason. Maybe Yamaha comes back.
I do have a question.
V4? Yeah,
what's up? Do you think that... in spite of like KTM's recent financial struggles, I know they're racing for the next year. Mm-hmm. Do you think that will affect their racing program for this coming year? Because what I want to see is also Pedro Acosta also perform really good. But
so you're curious if I think that they could see potential issues like throughout the season because of that? No, I don't think there'll be a problem. I think that when KTM starts their season, they get allotted like the KTM MotoGP team gets allotted blank check.
This many monies?
Yeah, from KTM. They're like, here you go, go do your season. It's their job to kind of do that. Now, like, if they... oh, man, you're asking me about, like, the inner workings of money in MotoGP, and I have no idea how any of that works.
So, at least for F1, you start... it's all fun and games. There's a cost cap. You start wadding up vehicles, then it's like...
right, so that's what I was going to say, is that, like, if Pedro Acosta, for whatever reason, or Brad Binder are just dumping KTMs, like, seven times every weekend...
yeah.
I could see that starting to become an issue, but I do know that KTM's doing a lot of work on the sidelines because they don't want to leave MotoGP. So I think they'll be here for MotoGP this year. KTM will stick around. My personal, like, this is all purely opinion. This is just my guess at what's going on in the future. I think that we will see, like, a total makeover or redo of KTM throughout the year. But I think they... kind of pulled it in already, got everything under control. They're just sorting out a bunch of legal stuff. So
fair enough.
We'll see. I don't have any like data to back that. I don't know, but I don't see that affecting their season too much in MotoGP. I do see that affecting the commentators' excuses for people doing bad.
I think the commentators will say anything to fill up screen time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I said job, I get it, but like sometimes it's like, stop talking, please.
Yeah. I do think they're a bit like, I mean, if Pedro makes a big mistake or like, that'll be the tell, right? If Pedro, let's say, lays a bike down, or Brad, lays a bike down, comes in and has to ride a bike that they rebuilt over the night and it's not really ready to go because KTM doesn't have the financials, like, I could see that being a reoccurring excuse. But I don't think it'll be too big of a deal.
Yeah.
But
I only ask because, like, in F1, you start. Sorry to keep bringing F1. You start like wadding up cars, like I said before.
Mm-hmm.
They start prioritizing like, which rider gets what.
Yeah.
If the budget is kind of like tight, and I know MotoGP, you see bikes go down way more often.
Yeah.
I know that was the one weekend Pedro had where he like, I think he wrecked out
a lot.
he wrecked out the sprint and the race, like from like either the lead or second place, and like it broke my heart because I was like, this is it. And it's gone.
Yeah. Wow. Was that Japan last year, I think?
I don't remember. It was late in the season. I remember that.
Yeah.
I think he was battling Pecco for one of those when he laid it down.
It was sad. But, I mean, at the same time, you know, he was a rookie last year. I'm really hoping that Pedro kind of got all that washed out of his system and he's good to go and he can lay down a solid season. But, yeah. This is for the audience. This is your warning. We will be doing a JK Moto podcast fantasy once again.
Oh yeah.
If If Grid Rival is doing MotoGP, we will use Grid Rival. If not, we will just stick with the MotoGP ran fantasy. So be on the lookout for that. You know, go ahead and start doing your research now. We'll start to kind of slip in some MotoGP things here and there. Also, just a reminder, we are not a weekly motorcycle podcast anymore. We are going to be a bi-weekly with no promises on only bi-weekly, but at least bi-weekly. So we will have an episode at least every other week, and then we'll cover MotoGP every week. So every week that it happens. So that's what we're sticking to. I think that wraps up MotoGP. Unless you had any other ideas or thoughts.
Oh, back to Yamaha V4. I'm hoping that it changes the game. I'd love to see them up in the top couple teams.
Yeah, I mean, the only sad part about that, you know, when I first started watching, I didn't realize that Honda had a V4, right?
Don't tell me that, but they do.
Yeah, right? So, like, because in my head, CBR, inline four, so Honda's going to have an inline four, Suzuki, inline four, right? And the R1 is inline, like, anyway, I thought the street bikes were a direct representation. Didn't realize until halfway through my first season watching that Honda was on some random crazy V4
bike. Yeah, it's because, like, I think World Superbike is, like, the thing that you can buy souped up to, like, the most best version of it, but it still resembles what you can buy, whereas MotoGP is, like, prototypes.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And Honda made the decision to go V4 a long, long time ago. I'm excited the Yamaha's going V4, especially because, like, realistically, in my head, there's no reason to keep the inline 4 around because the R1's dead. R6 is dead.
That is more of outside forces why those bikes are dead.
Yeah,
however,
but
fingers crossed, I'm pretty sure the R9 is going to sell really well if it's anything like the R7. It'll get a lot of hate, but the sales numbers, I'm confident, will be there. R7 gets a lot 100%. Of hate, but it's the most selling thing they own, aside from, like, the MT-07, MT-09s.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see the R9 getting near as much hate as the R7, because the R7 came in, it wanted, the people wanted it to be the old. And Yamaha was like, nah.
The thing is, invested bikers wanted that. The average, like, new biker, like myself, I didn't know that the R7 was a pre-existing, like, title. I think back in, like, early 2000s, 90s, and, like, what it was. Mm-hmm. I just knew that 7 looked bigger than 6, but then I would be told that, no, that's not how that works. Inline 4 versus parallel twin, I'd be like, so which one do I take if I don't want to, you know, if I want to be a beginner? They're like, just start with the R7, it's pretty much fine. I had no problems with it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I
still want an R6 though, but they're so expensive.
Yeah. Good luck.
Price is only going up.
Expensive and hard to find. Harder and harder every day.
Yeah. We have R6
home. I think Yamaha came in on the R7. I love the R7. You know, I've ridden your bike quite a bit. I love it. It's a great bike. I think that hate and discontent that's out there is mostly just from, and you're right, you know, it's the invested biker. But that, I think that's where that stems from. Is people are, like, expecting a Yamaha R750, essentially, right? So you got the R6.
Like the Gixxer?
Yeah, right.
Hey, so Gixxer's still selling these. Suzuki's still selling these. They're still selling good money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, haven't put it out yet as we're speaking, but just put out a video a few weeks ago about the Gixxer 750. So go check that out. That'll be linked up here. Nice. That's what's going on in my head. Where was it? Yeah, anyway, so Yamaha, MotoGP. I think the R9 is going to do great. That's what I was actually getting at. Sorry. Yeah. Backtracking. We're back. The R9 is going to do great, and here's my reasoning. One, it's more power than the R7, but it's, like, just the same. It's got the cool little winglets. Everyone loves the
winglets. Everyone loves winglets.
You can hate on the winglets all you want, but everyone loves the freaking winglets.
I may not be going fast enough to make them work, but damn, will I look cool doing
it. Yeah, right? It's just like the brake lever guard. Anyway.
controversial topic.
Winglets. You got to have the downforce, right? You got to have the downforce. But I don't think, like, no one's looking at the R9 and saying, this is an R1 replacement. Everyone is, like, everyone at this point understands leader bikes are gone. The 600 Screamers are gone. The inline four amazingness that happened, that era is over. We got about 18, 20 years of it. We're done for. It's over. Who cares, right?
Thanks, emissions.
Yeah, I would argue someone's going to blow me up in the comments. Go for it, please. But it was more than 18 to 20 years. I understand that. In my head, the era didn't start until 2006, because I think that's when the bikes started looking the best. Yeah. Anyway, so I think the R9 would do great. But I don't fault Yamaha at all for going to a V4. I'm a little sad to see the last inline four on the MotoGP grid, like, leaving. But, you know, if Suzuki comes back, Or, as Cole would say, if BMW is coming,
I'd love to see that.
Are they going
to
bring an inline four? And so that'll be kind of the question is, you know, either of those two guys could come in. And BMW has already said they're coming in. They're just going to wait until
the 2026 regulations with the eight fifties.
Yeah, which is I think 2027. Yeah, so we got two more seasons of this. Yeah, at the 850 CCs. So I guess only time will tell, but that'll kind of be the deciding factor. But yeah, I think that's also a reason why Yamaha's like, hey, let's go ahead and design a new engine, is because let's get some testing, let's get some numbers in this other configuration. And so we can kind of decide which way we want to go when we jump down to the 850s. Hopefully. I hope they're looking ahead that much. I don't know. They could also just be looking for enough power to keep up on the streets. So
the Ducatis have got that, I'll tell you that.
They do. They do. I will never forget, like, 3 years ago when Suzuki was still here and Juan Mir came out onto the straight on the finishing lap, like he had it. He had held first for a while. He had that win. Comes out and then Ducati just, literally, dude, it did not look like the Ducati passed him. It looked like Juan Mir just paused and just stayed there. Like
it was a drag race, but he just didn't have it in him.
Yeah, dude, it was sad. It was sad to see. So, but yeah, hopefully Yamaha shows up with that, does some good stuff. Yeah, it'll be telling when they show their liveries. That'll be a good one to watch because MotoGP will be commentating on it and kind of talking you through all that. But yeah, I think that's the end of MotoGP coverage.
Fair enough.
Cool. We got to get into the other topic. I don't know. Let's start this off. I don't know why I've been on such a crash kick. Actually, I can tell you why. I was on Facebook. I was on Track Day Addicts. Before I ever made a post on there, there was a dude that got on and said, "Hey, I haven't done any track days yet, but realistically, am I going to crash? Or how likely is it that I'm going to crash?" Something along those lines, right?
It's like a question like that is like, it depends on so many factors.
Yeah.
Because you could go around the track riding like 40 miles an hour, you never crash.
Yeah.
I would advise going that slow. If go the speed you're comfortable with.
Yeah. So I saw that and I was going to comment on it and then I was like, no. I looked, I think there were like 122 comments on there already. I was like, all right, yeah, I'll just stay out of that.
Yeah, everyone's got an opinion on stuff like Tri-Wear and stuff like that. Everyone's got an opinion.
Yep. So I hopped back on and I said, well, hey, let's look at like statistically, just purely take all the factors that you mentioned out of it and just say, okay, what has everyone else done? That led to the video of like, how likely is it that you will crash? We came up with by your 10th track day, most likely, and usually the average is right around that 9.5, 10, right? So somewhere on there, your 9th track day on average is when you wreck. And I got a little bit of flack for that survey. It wasn't like super, I'm not trying to be technical. I'm not a math nerd.
But it's like sample size was too small,
yeah,
or something?
Yeah, well, that and the way I did certain numbers, anyway, whatever. No, I didn't like go down to a science. I just wanted a rolling average of some sort. Sample size was about 80. And we got 9 to 10 track days, you lay a bike down. So, which I think people have trouble arguing that because it's like pretty realistic. I know for me it was a little higher than that.
I do think it also depends because like, what do you define as crash? Just laying the bike down? Like, you can go off the track in the warm-up lab, just in the dirt, while you're stopping, come to mostly a stop and the bike tips over and you pick it up and you get back on track and you ride off. Or like, tell my straight up like low side or high side.
I think in my head, a crash, like if you...
Because I've definitely done that. I'm like, I'm in the dirt. All right, stop. Ooh, pothole. All right. Oopsie doopsie, boop boop.
Yeah, I'd like.
Bean's got plenty of videos in blowing quarters. Go get to the dirt.
I think, like in my opinion, that wouldn't count. I think I would put it at like if you put the bike down, out on the track during a session, and you can't just. Yeah,
bike's gonna take it back to the paddock for me.
If you tracked by riding on the track, or if you wrecked by riding on the track.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. Because, I mean, sometimes you can low side and still pick the bike up and ride it back. Sometimes. Yep. Not very often, but sometimes. You shouldn't. I think like, a lot of orgs have rules against that or whatever.
Yeah, your track day org will tell you what their stance is at the riders' meeting in the morning.
Yeah, right. So your example of if it's coming back on the trailer, yeah, 100%. Also that. But I would say like if you ride off the track and you're upright and you're like, woo, and then the grass is a little slippery or you hit a patch of gravel and you just can't keep it up, yeah, I'm not going to count that. No. But if you're out on the asphalt and that's when you lose traction, you slip or high side or whatever, that's what I would call a wreck. So I ran that survey. I put out that info. It was pretty interesting, kind of cool to look at. One dude had done like 82 track days before he ever put one down. There were several people on there who was like, I've been doing this for 50 years, never put a bike down. And it just kind of got me thinking of like, realistically, what is it that makes someone wreck or not?
So I do think there's a couple of things to go to it. I know you have an analogy talking about like a cliff, mm-hmm. and like how fast you go to the edge of the cliff. Like you can go really fast to it and go over it. You go like really close to it, carefully, slowly, see where it is, and you might tip over it, but now you kind of have a better idea of where it's at. I've seen like it both ways. I've seen people absolutely get on the track, absolutely may not have the skills to pay the bills, but absolutely just have a set on them, and yeah. they just absolutely send it, and they yeah. find where the limit is, and like because they blew over the limit so fast, they have an idea that it exists now, but they don't know like where it was, so they do that a few more times, so they calibrate it. I've seen people who go on a track day more timid, more cautious, to like overly cautious, to just more cautious in general, and eventually they find it and they might just low side and slide out. I know we had a friend that was in North Carolina with us on the Aprilia RS660. I know that he had been doing a decent amount of track days. Mm-hmm. I know that he was pretty good because I had been like an MSF course with him, so I knew like he at least had street skills. I seen him do like track day stuff, so he was like, I would argue, a pretty experienced rider. I don't yeah. know if you I'm pretty yeah. sure you agree.
I'd agree, 100%.
And he low-sided the same like corner I low-sided on that track, and like he had just been progressing all day, slowly getting more and more and more, and then eventually he just was riding the limit a little too aggressively, and it just went out from under him. I mean, he got up, bike still ran, but like he found that limit. It didn't happen the first day. It happened toward the end of the day when he was just chasing more and more. I guess what, tenths, seconds, over his lap time? Whereas when I found that, I was like, I can lean the bike this far. I can lean the bike this far. I cannot lean the bike this far. And then obviously my body position got fixed in November.
Yeah.
Down in Texas.
So that's our last podcast episode 94, I was talking to a dude named Antley. And he said something that, you know, kind of rang true pretty hard. We also kind of talked about crashing a little bit on that, because that's a kick I've been on lately is crashing. And I personally, I don't know. He was of the opinion that crashing doesn't have to be a part of the sport. And I agree with that sentiment, but I don't think we'll ever get there. I think we could reduce it a little bit, but I don't think we'll ever get to the point where like crashing is not a part of the sport.
In terms of like in general, like at the highest level, like?
No, I think we'll limit it to like club racing.
Fair enough.
I would limit it there. Once you're professionally racing, I would say that's a little different.
I do think, take this with a grain of salt, take this however you take this. If you are trying to get better and you're constantly finding the limit of like grip, mm-hmm. which based on a myriad of factors is always changing, right? It could be tire temps, road temps, tire surface weather, how are you feeling that day? All those things can be changing.
Yep.
If you are consistently trying to go the fastest, you will be riding that limit of grip. And if you make a mistake riding the limit, you go over the limit. That can result in either a really cool slide or straight up just a low side or a high side, depending on like how you do it.
Right.
If your goal is not to be the fastest and chase like the absolute fastest, sure, your ability to crash might go really down depending if you have like a decent skill set and you're riding well within your means. But like if you are, I would argue if you are racing, mm-hmm. Unless everybody is at like below your skill level, like, are you really pushing the limit?
Yeah, 100%, right? Because if you're out there on
just regular track days, if you're not pushing, sure. But yeah. if you're like you are pushing, you will flirt with that limit, and that comes risk with that.
Yeah, no, I mean 100%, and like realistically, I think you could say you look at the whole group or the whole sport. We'll say, and once again, this is from club racing town. We're talking like the top club racers down to the newbie track day guy. Yeah. You look at that whole sport and you say, okay, everyone could ride at 94% and then we want to never wreck, right? But you're never going to do that if you're on the grid racing. And maybe, you know, to Antley's point, maybe he was just talking about track days.
That's fair. You don't need to take as many risks when you're just doing regular track. I would agree. You could significantly lower the amount of crashes that happen on track day, like that one time in North Carolina.
Like that one time there was red flag, red flag, red flag. And then, like, in my head, crashing on a track, not a bad thing. want to put that out there.
Also, my logic has always been
this. This is the safest place to find said limit.
Yes.
There are things I'll do here in a safer environment, closer to what I think my limit is, that I'll never go to the street.
Mm-hmm. As you should.
It's just that sometimes you, the limit you think you had is not the limit that you were good for.
Yeah.
Shout out to our friend, was that Road Atlanta, when he decided he'd finally send it, and eventually he just, low-sided, was at 6'7".
Yeah. Yeah, he got a little bored near the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, so you brought up last session of the day, right?
Tale as old as time.
I've wrecked a bike twice on the track. You've wrecked the one time?
Yeah, the one time.
Out of curiosity, what number of track day was that?
In terms of like raw days or track weekends? We count track weekends as 2 days or 1 day?
Like day on track.
Give me a second.
7, 17,
19. Well, I'm at 5 hours. Right, give me a second. I think that might have been like day 7 or 8.
So you're kind of pretty close to that average. That's good. I was also probably 7 or 8, maybe 9.
It was second day of that track. I was feeling real comfortable passing people on the outside.
I do want to break down yours specifically because I'm curious. I also recently put out a video of like what you do after the crash. And one of the most important things I think is being able to analyze like, okay, why did it happen, right? So you talk about my cliff analogy. I love that analogy because the cliff of traction, you fall off the edge, that's a wreck. Obviously, you lose your traction. I love that analogy because I think that, as I've mentioned, so that last like 20% of the edge of the cliff is the most important, right? Because it's realistically, that's where you have to ride, or even that last 5%, that last 1% is where you have to ride if you want to truly be the fastest, right? So if you jut straight off the edge of the cliff, you're never going to catch it. It's going to be a blur. But if you can edge closer and closer to that, and get that 20, 15, 10, 5, and get a good look at what that edge of that cliff actually looks like, then you can start to kind of piece that together and you have that in your back pocket. So part of that is once you do fall off the cliff, can you go back and tell yourself like, okay, realistically, where was I? Where did I make that mistake? What did the cliff look like?
For that crash, I'm pretty sure I knew what happened. Okay. So like even looking at the track day photos, like I was leading the bike, but I wasn't getting my body off of the bike, mm-hmm. which is not the end of the world. Up until a certain lean angle, then it obviously is a big problem.
Yep.
I came into a corner a little too hot. It was like a kind of like a sweeping right. Sweeping left into a sweeping right into a larger sweeping left.
Okay. Yep.
Right before you get to that last sweeper to put you on the main straight.
Tracking.
And that sweeping left, when I flipped like transition over, I didn't really get myself off the bike, and at that point I was kind of committed. And I just wanted to keep the line, but I know as I was like, you know, now on the line I wanted to go on, so I leaned the bike a little bit more. Looking back now, I should have like got myself off the bike to get that same like rate of change I actually wanted to get. So I just tipped the bike over. Eventually it was going, and then I was just sliding on the ground out, right? It was like kind of happened all in slow-mo. I was like, I'm good. Okay, I'm not good. I guess we're here. All right, there we go.
Yeah, okay.
And then like looking back, if I'd set that up a little better, just used any amount of body position, I don't think it would have been that like bad. It wasn't like I was like going that fast, to be honest. It was just
okay. So you like, think it is purely just too much lean angle is where you were at.
Skill issue.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's always a skill issue, honestly.
Fair enough.
If you're reckoning, well, okay. Blah, blah, blah. Caveat. Oil on the track, cooling on the track. I'll give you those. Anything else, I'm going to say skill issue. But
it was a learning experience though. Like, cause when I saw the photos, I was like, the bike, me, not that.
Yeah.
Right. So I was using
kinda actually like opened eyes.
Yeah, I was using tire, and then eventually I tried to use tire I didn't have, and the bike said, "I'm giving you all I got, dude."
That's it. That is the.
So that was like between right like that happening, feeling it in the moment, and then like seeing the pictures. Like I was like, "Oh, that's obvious. Like that is not what I should be looking like if I'm gonna lean that far over."
All right. Well, that's good. I mean, Yeah, I had a very similar experience for my first one. I do think I had my body off far enough. I was adding way too much throttle, and I was doing it on purpose. I was following this freaking R6 around a long, long left-hand turn, the carousel at the ridge. And I know you've probably heard this story, but I looked at them and I was like, dude, holy cow. If they can lean that far, I can lean that far. But I didn't like have enough speed to
your entry, out far your entry enough. Speed wasn't there, right. So you're trying to commit once you were leaned over in the corner.
Yeah, so what I was trying to do was lean over more, because I knew I could lean over more. If you lean over more, you sink to the inside of the turn. So to counteract that, you add throttle to get yourself back out.
There is an amount of throttle you can add doing that, but right? It is an amount.
Which then also increases your speed through the corner, and you shave off some time, which realistically, you don't actually save off that much time. Like, I was trying to shave off 3 seconds in a lap, and that was not the place to do it, and I found that out. But yeah, I just kept leaning further, adding throttle. And it was, like, very slow and controlled. And then eventually the bike was just like, no. Yeah, rear tire specifically was like, no, you're doing too much. And so it shoved me off.
I might have been there for that one.
You were watching, I think.
That looks cool. That looks less cool. I hope he's all right.
But I'm curious to get your kind of thoughts and opinions, because I walk you through everything that I was thinking. In the moment, I was like, all right, I'm good. You know, I'd been planning on this happening for years at this point. But like, walk me through in the moment after the wreck. You let the bike go. You know, you said you were there kind of slow motion. You realize it's gone. What was next? What happened?
Slide on the pavement very quickly. I was sliding in the grass. Did a few rolls. I was with the bike. I'm sliding. The bike's there. I'm here. I understand we're both moving. Mm-hmm. Eventually get in the dirt. I then, like, try and get up. I'm like, all right, well, I'm up. I know. Get away from the track.
Yeah, okay.
Get my bike away from the track. All right, sweet. My bike is not near the racing line. It's not near the track. All right, sweet. I need to move away from the track now. they put all that out in your track day briefing in the morning for the riders meeting.
Yeah.
So I move out what I think is a far enough distance. Corner worker's like, go a little further out. And I'm like, sounds good. I go a little further out. He sees that I'm up, so like, I'm ambulatory, obviously. Eventually the session ends. They like put the like little trash cart, because I need like an ambulance or anything, because it was a low side.
Yeah.
Crash cart comes over, loads my bike up, do a little off switch thing so I can go back. So put it off, load up in the crash cart. Relatively, what I would say is minimal damage. Fairing scratches, which is why I like replaced the fairings on that side.
It was the R7?
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Yeah, because that's what we did, new clip-ons on that?
Yeah, one of the clip-ons was sheared, and the rear set, the foot peg and the foot peg and the clutch lever was kind of sheared. But aside from like the poking out bits, everything else looked like it was mostly either just bent or fine. So it was like minor cosmetic damage, but I was like, this is an excuse to buy those aftermarket parts I've always had in my eyes.
That is the best part about fashion.
I saw it. I was like, all right, sweet. When we brought it back to the paddock, I looked at the engine. Looks like it's got some scrapes on the engine cover. Looks like some scrapes on the frame sliders. But like fairing scratches, a minute wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. Because I still rode it for like months after that, like with those fairings on.
Right.
All we did was like change out the clip-ins and the rear sets. And I think that was really it for the most part. Maybe like a new lever for the clutch and then like a new lever on the rear set for that side.
Yep.
I think that was it. Turned the bike on, it ran. Could strip through gears if you manually did it. I was like, oh, okay. Like,
yeah. So from a personal standpoint, I'm curious, because I can tell you about exactly the point when my adrenaline finally actually wore off. Do you know, or maybe you just don't have that problem?
No, different. I knew when my adrenaline ran off, because when we drove home, I was like, oh, my foot hurts.
Okay.
And I was like, it just hurt, because when I was sliding on the pavement, I banged it.
Yeah.
It's fine. It wasn't broken or anything, but it was like, you're there, like you're good. It was like, get the bike back. Does the bike work? And then like later that day on the drive home, I was like,
so think it was probably about like days over, packed up, drive home, finally relaxed, and you finally really calmed down and everything wore off. Okay.
Because as soon as that session was over, it was like, how do you fix the bike? All right, sweet. We gotta load these bikes up. We got like a 4 or 5 hour drive home. So like, I was freaking out about like getting it up.
Yeah.
With like, obviously like you don't have a clutch on that side or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Oh,
so
yeah,
now it's just like, now it's just an extra hassle. And then we were loading like 3 bikes with one open trailer and one in the bed, two in the open trailer, one in the bed. So I was like trying to figure that out. And then like the buddy I rode with also laid his Aprilia down, R660, in that like early in that day as well. So it was like, we're loading 2 broken bikes in the truck. And like, now it's just extra like hassle. And I was like, all right, sweet.
Yeah, just kind of figuring all that out. That makes sense. Yeah, I'd say maybe that was a bigger difference too. When I did my first wreck, it was on a 2-day, and so I was like, dude, I was pushing to get that bike back out there.
Oh yeah, because you still had another day to ride.
Yeah.
Whereas in North Carolina, right? So, we were on the way out.
Yep. Because it was like the last session before lunch, so I got my bike back pretty quickly because I had to wait for lunch for them to bring the bike around. and they unloaded it, and I immediately started just going nuts. And I think, like, I looked at it. I might have bought the part before they even brought the bike back, because I needed clip-ons. So I went over and bought some clip-ons.
You do end up buying parts at the track, like your gas cap over there.
Yeah.
Oh, gas cap over there.
I never bought one of those. They didn't have it.
What'd you do in Georgia?
A sock and some duct tape. And we kept the fuel level real low.
Farewell.
Turns out if it's leaking, you can feel it because your chest gets real cold. I want to know that from experience, but yeah, that's what they say.
Bigger balls than me.
Yeah, that's how we rode that whole day. It was a good time. Where was I? Anyway, yeah, I went and immediately bought clip-ons, came back, got the bike, was looking over all of it, got the clip-ons put on. Once I was done with that, I finally started kind of like to calm down and realize, because I think I realized at that point I'm not going to make it back out today, right?
I think once you make peace with that, like, you're no longer rushed to do certain jobs that you could do fast, but because you're not in the right headspace, you might miss a lot of things.
Yeah.
And certain things on your bike, like, you do not want to play with, like, I think brakes are one of them, like,
yeah,
anything like that, any of your shifting stuff, in case you're, like, on the track and now you're, like, you get a false neutral, you can't shift your gears properly. Now you're stuck in a gear wear high that you want to be for certain areas, or, like, you're just stuck in a way lower gear.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, it's 'cause I had grass and dirt and just everything built up all over that thing. And it wasn't until, like I said, I think I finally kind of realized, like, oh, hey, you're not going back out today. Just take your time, get it ready for tomorrow. That's when I started to, like, actually look around, like I had to pull my rear tire off because there was grass stuck between the, it might have been the front, actually. I think it was the front. There was grass stuck between the rim and the bead.
Like up in here?
Yeah, right. That's so right between, like, the tire wall and the bead, just, like, shoved with grass. So I had to break that bead almost. I don't remember if I had to break it or if I was able to just kind of scrape it out. But I was like, well, I don't want to go out with that on there.
Yeah, because you're just flinging that up on the track.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's when that adrenaline finally kind of wore out. And like I said, you know, for me, just going back to how important I think it is to, like, be able to analyze what happened so that you can add that to the list of things to not do. For me, it was very painfully clear exactly what I did because I knew what I was doing in the moment. And I was like, it's kind of funny because going back, I was hoping it would stick, but in the back of my head, I was like, this might not stick, but I don't know. That guy looks like he's doing it. Let's try it. And obviously it didn't stick, so I didn't apply it quite right.
I've learned there's so many factors that goes into, like, different things in following people, and, like, you may not be doing all of those things, so when you try to do it, it might not work out. Like, in your case, like, you didn't have the same entry he had.
Yeah.
You were adding throttle and lean, whereas he had probably just sent it, stuck it, and was, like, just in the corner with maintenance throttle.
Yep.
Whereas you were like, I'm falling behind. Let me try to do two separate things in conjunction, which if your skill level is high enough, you can do because you know how much you can do. Because, like, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, the telemetry data on, like, people doing laps.
Yeah.
There's one dude I follow. You watch his telemetry. You watch the point at which he starts adding throttle, and there's still animato, like, more lean angle than I have when I'm adding throttle.
Right.
And, like, it's not like he's, like, eating on the throttle. Like, he's, like, it's an amount, and as the bike is up, the rate goes up. And you can watch the lines of telemetry data. Same thing for when he's braking and releasing the brakes for trail braking. And it's, like, way more aggressive than someone at a lower skill level would do it, obviously. But, like, there is an amount you can get away with, but, like, if you mess it up, like, he would show you where the traction control would kick in, and he was using that to, like, have an idea of where his line was so that he wouldn't go over it.
Hmm. Okay.
Like, this is your limit. And he would purposely try to go over a little bit and, like, let traction control kick on. So you can see on the telemetry data and be like, all right, this much lean angle, this much throttle, or this much this, ABS or traction control would try and kick in. And then it'd be like, he used that to calibrate how much he could get away with. And I think it's more than the average person thinks, but there is still a limit.
Yeah, well, and it's got to, that's those other factors too, because that really, like, you need to know yourself. You need to know, like,
how
smoothly are you applying that.
I wouldn't try something like that. But obviously, he'd been doing it for long enough. Like, this dude, like, is at a level. Like, he probably A group. He, like, races. He's got plenty of the. He's got his yellow numbers, all that good stuff.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's what's cool about the data is, like, you look at the data, you know, crash data specifically, and you can see all of that. But I will say, you know, my second wreck on this bad boy right here. Yeah, that one.
Hey, it looks frame slide to save your wingless though.
Yeah, kind of. I still need a new one there, but that's fine. But this wreck,
I didn't actually know what happened until we were down in Texas. It finally started to, like, all of the pieces came together and clicked. And I knew I lost the front, so I knew, like, what happened physically to the bike for it to lay down, but I didn't realize why I had lost the front. And it was actually due to, I was at AMP, Atlanta Motorsports Park, for those of you that are in Arizona and don't know what Atlanta Motorsports Park is. Yes, I've ridden both.
Anyways.
Someone gave me a comment once when we were talking about Podium Club. He's like, oh, this guy probably likes AMP. And so I was joking back with him. I'm like, at Atlanta Motorsports Park? He's like, no, I was talking about Arizona. I was like,
I got to get out there, man. I got to get back on the West Coast / that area of the country.
Yeah, Podium Club is sweet. Sweet, sweet. The track review that we did got very bad rating because, well, there were like 4 porta potties. And that was it. There's no running water, no nothing.
It's like a new track, and the facilities are still being set up around it.
Yeah, and I mean, that was 2 years ago. It could be a lot better now.
Yeah, I remember when I went to the Ridge for the first time, there was a dude, he was like, I remember this was just a track in a dirt parking lot. Yeah. And I was like...
Well, the first time I went to the Ridge, there was a paved parking lot, kind of, nowhere near as big as it is now, and then the bathroom building. That was it. That was it. There was like a trailer.
I know when I came to visit, I know that came, the like, first time I came to watch you and you were there, like, it was... I was like, oh, they've got, like, a really nice track. Oh, they've got, like, a little bridge. Oh, they've got, like, a seating area. Oh, they've got, like a food merchant shop area. Paddock's pretty big. Oh, they've got, like, some other stuff over here. Oh, all tracks must be like this.
No.
I've since learned that they're not all like that.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately not. But,
I was like, I gotta do this again.
This guy... We were down talking to Josh, and he mentioned, you know, unloading your front tire. And so this turn specifically, you're very slow, a very slow right-hander, and then you come left, and you're going, like, down and around a hill, still very slow. And so what had happened was that...
You're going down the hill.
Yeah, right? And it's also off-camber, which was a good part of it. I'm not going to blame the off-camber, but that does make it a little more tricky. And so for my specific scenario, I come out of the right, I flick it down to the left, and then I didn't like fully plant the bike.
That front
there,
tire.
Right. And so that the front, as soon as I had a little more lean angle, the front wasn't loaded. It never actually like stuck. So it just let go. When I thought it was loaded and it was ready to go. And I think that's because realistically, I was trying to kind of pick up my pace. You know, it was my first time riding this thing on track. I was starting to get used to it, which was a really sad way to test it out on track for the first time. I'm not a big fan of blaming tires, but knowing what tires you're on and knowing their actual limits is important. Because I was on a like sport touring tire, and I don't know if it was actually super. I don't know if it was warmed up enough to give me more grace. We'll put it that way. That's what happened there. But like I said, that took me like a year and a half to actually realize like I didn't have that front tire loaded. It wasn't actually gripping the track in that moment.
Interesting. It's also different like if you're trying to get better by yourself and you don't know what you're looking for, like when you're, because you don't have like footage of you, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Whereas if like you do have footage of you, even if you just have like a 360, like a GoPro mount and then like your telemetry, you could like see something, you could break it down with somebody else and know what they're looking for. Even if I just have like a coach or someone who's actually following you, not necessarily a coach, maybe a friend who knows what's going on.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, like, my riding, for the most part, I never had a coach other than someone showing me the lines, like, at a track day, right? Mm-hmm. No one's saying, you're doing this, 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 you're doing this. And then, like, after that, I was like, oh, here's a laundry list of things I could work on, and I could just do this one thing per session. And then when I get that, I could work on something else. Like, that was, like, it's game-changing, like, how exponential it could affect your growth. Like, if you had known the tire thing, like, when it happened... Like, you could have been working on that forever ago and not just have it be a thing that, like, was in the back of your head.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I will say, you know, that specific corner had very specific circumstances that I haven't really run into. That very slow speed, you're diving from one to the other and then off camber going down a hill is, like, interesting circumstances. It's a tricky turn. Like, literally.
One thing I've noticed, I mean, cut you off, but one thing I know about tricky turns is, like, even professionals, we went to, Barber in Atlanta to watch Moto America. You would watch professionals, wipe out in the same corner coming down that hill from where Cole was sitting.
Yeah.
And you watch them all wipe out right there or blow the corner leading up to it.
Yep.
And I thought that was interesting. Like, even at the highest level, at a high, significantly higher level, it's like, is this corner tricky?
Yeah, well, and then, you know, that made me feel better in the moment, because when the crash truck came, they're like, oh, yeah, that's a tricky one, huh? I was like,
especially if you ask locals at the track, like, hey, what should I look out for? They usually can tell you, like, this spot right here because of these reasons. Whereas if you don't have that information, you might not be, like, you know, like fully prepared going into it.
CMP turn one in the morning where everyone wrecks first session.
Yeah.
Everyone wrecks first session there because they came in way too hot. And, yeah. Oh, man. Well, and
especially if the corner's, like, you would think the racing line is this line, but because this one corner's tricky, the racing line is just a little bit off of what you think the ideal line would be, and it's because it sets you up for this, like, weird condition for that track.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's where the local, the coach...
I've learned so much about, like, lines in the last year. Like, before I was like, I understand that a racing line is a thing that you say. I don't know what it means. And then, like, you do, it's like, oh, if I am off this line, I am messed up for the next few corners.
Yeah,
I'm going to stay on this line, and I can hold the most speed. And if I set up like this, I'll be fine. And if I'm not fine, I'll lose time. Like, I will lose seconds.
Yeah. Was this, and so that, my next question is, was there any reserve on your riding after the wreck?
No.
Really?
Yeah. And the reason I was, okay, that's not entirely true. There was some reserve, but it wasn't like, I'm never riding again. It was, this is the limit. Don't do that again. Don't do that thing again.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like, I'm never riding again. It was like, I need to get parts on this bike so I can go back out there and then, like, get my skill level to a point where I won't put myself in that situation again. Because it was like, I love riding. I may not be the fastest, but, like, I do really enjoy that. I enjoy, like, motorcycles in general. And I do think one of the things that was able to help me get back on the bike so quickly was, like, I got up and walked away. Like, if I broke something, obviously I might have been more jaded. But, like, I got up, walked away, crash cart, brought my bike back, and my bike still run. I just had broken cosmetic parts.
Yeah.
The suit, I mean, it gave me confidence in the suit. Even though it was, like, a cheap suit, it made me want to get a... It's like a $500 like suit off of Cycle Gear, right? But it made me want to get a better suit because, like, if this protected me from that, maybe, like, even a better suit and an airbag would help me if it was worse. The fact that the bike was still running was like, all right, sweet. This is don't do that again, and you won't have that. But if it was, like, a high side, like, I broke something, I probably would have been like, ooh.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's not like you're on the street and got hit by a car, right?
Yeah, right, and that's the...
That made me apprehensive. That would make me apprehensive.
And that's my favorite part, right, about track days is that, like, realistically, most of your wrecks that you do see, and I'm saying, you know, most, I say that because it can be a bunch of other things, I understand that.
I've seen way more serious wrecks, and if that happened to me, I would be apprehensive, but fortunately, that was not my case.
Yeah. But yeah, most of the time, it's a low side. Most of the time, you're coming out pretty safe, you're coming out pretty unjarred, and you can kind of get back on and go again. I will say...
It happened in slow motion, too, so it's like, I'm here, I'm not there. Part. Whereas, like, if you're on the street, it's like, I'm good. Why is that cart?
Dead. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't mean to laugh. It's not funny.
I've seen too many crash comps.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, I'll say that after my first one, there was definitely some reserve. I was a little wary. And maybe still a little wary of putting throttle on mid-turn, mid-corner. What's weird is, like, I've had instances where... very similar long left-hand turns, and I'm adding throttle because you can. And I've had a bike slip out that I caught. I was good. I've been able to do it with absolutely no problem and continue to do it more and more all day. So, like, I've had similar positive experiences since, but I do think that still kind of, like, lives in the back of my head is, like, hey, don't do this.
Yeah,
so.
One of the things I learned, well, not really learned, but, like, one of the things I went into motorcycle thinking was, like, don't add throttle with lean angle. But, like, you can add throttle while leaned over. It's more of don't add throttle and lean angle at the same time. Because, like, that thing, that one drill we did at Drosh, was, like, you just, here's your diameter circle, here's another diameter circle. You will transition between, like, these diameter circles using only the throttle. It's like, well, I'm leaned over.
Yep.
Oh. Oh. Oh.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah, you can do it. And that's what's kind of crazy. That's why it's so cool to get on the mini motos. And to do some of that, like, cross-training stuff is to see that in a, like, way slower, more controlled, not big, giant, scary bike status and see it where you can actually kind of use it. And that's why I love that.
It, like, in that drill, I was like, oh, there's a few corners I know that I'm going to put myself on. Like, this corner is going into the main straight. If I hit this lean angle and I have throttle, I can add more to put me out back to the racing line would be and then stand a bike up fully on throttle.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, this is like a thing that people actually do. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it kind of opens your eyes to
no wonder, like, yeah.
Yeah. Crashing.
I think the biggest takeaway is, like, try to take away what you can from the crash so that you can improve your riding moving forward. I think usually you can't do that. Well, Grant, like, when somebody, like, ran at the back of you or something, like, you checked up, they hit you, or, like, they were riding above their skill level, yeah. They hit you. But, like, if, otherwise, you probably can take something away from it if you can, like, try to use that to improve your riding.
I agree, 100%. I mean, yeah, if you're not taking anything away from it, it was a total waste. Hmm. If your goal is to stay in the sport, and that's the hard part for me is, like, track day versus racing.
I do think that it comes to, like, what are your goals, right? If your goal is, like, if your goal is, like, I want to be a high-level racer, obviously the risk that you will take and the amount of commitment to your training and program and the things that you do is very different from someone who's, like, I like riding motorcycles. The track day allows me to ride it in a manner that is not legal on the street.
Right.
But my goal is to come here and enjoy motorcycle. Like, you see, like, one time I was at CMP, old dude on a Hayabusa, and I was like, hell yeah, brother.
Yep.
Even occasional Harleys you'll see there. It's like, well, you can go definitely fast and go in the street. He can definitely do way more than he can do in the street. Is he trying to race? No, but there should be a place reserved for, like, just the people who enjoy the sport.
Yeah, well, and that's something I'll preach all the time, right? Like, just because you do a track day doesn't mean you have to race. Racing is definitely fun, and I'm not saying anything against club racing, but there does need to be that reserved spot for, look, dude, I'm just trying to ride my bike in a safer manner, a little bit faster than I can on the street. With the recognition that if that's what you're doing, you are going to get people telling you how to go faster your entire career.
I do think if you do enough of that, you will inherently just slowly get faster. But I mean, like, if your goal is specifically to get faster and your goal is to just relax, I do think the speed at which they will get faster will be two very different rates. Like, if I'm going, I need to hit the corner this way, I need to hit the corner this way, sends for this corner, and then I can do this, this, and this, and I will shave seconds or tenths of seconds or hundreds of seconds, versus someone who's like, yeah, man, I just stay on this line and I get to open the throttle more than I can on the street. Eventually you get more comfortable with stuff, you'll get faster, but, like, nowhere near is, like, textbook breaking nobody
down. I will say,
like, take Bean for example,
the only caveat I would have to that is that I think there is a cap. If you're doing just the track day thing, I think there is a cap. I think most people cap out at the top of the B group. They're comfortable enough, they might head into the A group as just a track day rider, but realistically, their speed level is kind of capped out. Now, you know, correct me if I'm wrong there, for any of you guys.
I will say, though, fast B group people aren't, like, slow. I would argue a fast B group rider is safer and faster than the average street rider.
Yeah, oh yeah, no.
By, like, a significant margin.
Yeah,
A group is just, like, people who are taking that game to the next level, which has been doing it long enough, but, like...
Well, an A group is generally club racers, for the most part, so... Yeah. Well, that just about sums up what I had for the night. I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to discuss.
Maybe one of these days do an episode on, like, street riding.
All right, yeah, we could squeeze it in. We'll have to squeeze that in. Well, anyway, hey, we, kind of sums up our discussion topics for the night. Hopefully you guys enjoyed. Thank you guys for listening and or watching. Once again, if you're not on YouTube, go check it out. There's a YouTube channel, JK Moto Entertainment. Also check us out on Instagram and Facebook at JK Moto Entertainment. Give us a follow, like, subscribe, comment, leave some comments, please. If you have any questions, let us know down in the comments, and we will see you guys. Well, I don't know if Kelly will or not. We'll see. He'll be back more often than not, but we'll kind of see how the season goes. But we will see you guys in the next episode. Thanks for listening.
Peace.
Have you ever jerked your knee on the ground at 100 miles an hour?
Hang on, I gotta sneeze. Maybe.
Bless you.
Thank you.
Well, you're having performance anxiety over there.
I had to get the right tone.